This is Stellacast, episode 19. Hello and welcome to this episode of Stellacast, found online at stellaculinary.com, part of the Stella Culinary Podcasting Network. My name is Jacob Burton, and I'm your host, as always. And in this episode, we welcome to the program J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. Yes, that Kenji. I mean, how many Kenjis do you know? J. Kenji Lopez-Alt is the Managing Culinary Director for SeriousEats.com and author of their incredibly popular column, The Food Lab. He's also the author of the brand new book of the same title, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. And he is now able to call himself a New York Times best-selling author. That's right, his first book that he released is a New York Times best-selling book, and I have it here sitting in front of me. This sucker is heavy. It's a good, you know, 6-7 pounds, 1,000 pages long, very well constructed, and extremely detailed. Now, I've been aware of Kenji's work and a fan of his work for a good 3-4 years now, at least, probably longer. I mean, they all blend together over time, it seems. And so when he came out with his book, and I got it, I was like, you know what? I got to get this dude on the podcast. He probably won't do it because he has no idea who I am or what the hell a Stellacast even is. But, you know, I'm going to reach out to him. And sure enough, he got back to me and said, hey, man, get in touch with my publicist and we will talk. So without further delay, I'd like to welcome to the program J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, Managing Culinary Director of SeriousEats.com and author of The Food Lab.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I got to say, we're super excited to have you on Stellacast. You know, I've been following you for quite some time over on SeriousEats, your Food Lab blog. And I love how you break things down. Now, when I ordered your book, and it came, the first thing that really surprised me was the obvious massive amount of work that went into it. I mean, it's insane. What was that process like?
You know, it was one of those things where I didn't see it becoming that big either. You know, it's a big book. It's like it weighs almost 7 pounds, and it's like 1,000 pages. When I first started writing it, I thought it was going to be a quick project. It would take me maybe a year, maybe 2 years, and it was supposed to be around 350 pages. And that's actually what my contract said, 358 pages, I think is what it said. And then I started actually writing it, and, you know, by the time I sort of got the overall structure, and I was like, okay, each chapter is going to focus on the science of one specific type of cooking. So there's going to be a thing on the science of frying and the science of ground meat and the science of sauteing and all those things. Like, it just seemed, you know, each chapter seemed kind of empty to me without more in it. So it's like I'm writing about meatloaf. And if I'm writing about meatloaf, well, then I should be also writing about meatballs because the science applies to meatballs too. And if I'm writing about those, then I should also be writing about sausage and explaining how making a sausage is different from making a meatloaf and how that's all different from making a hamburger, you know. And all those things are sort of interconnected. And it doesn't make sense to – it seems almost like a waste to write about the science of one but not the others because understanding one can help you understand the others. So – So a year came and went, and then 2 years came and went, and I just kept adding more and more stuff, and it kind of all just snowballed into a bigger and bigger project. So by the time I finally turned it in, it was a year and a half late when I turned it in, and it was supposed to be 350 pages, and I turned in 800. And my editor, Maria Garnaschelli, she has a pretty fearsome reputation for cutting things, so I was fully expecting her to cut it down to 350 pages, but instead she said, you know, this is good. Can you give me another 800 pages? And so I said, yeah, I had to cut it just to get it down to this 800.
Wow.
So I spent another year working on more recipes and more writing, and it eventually became, 1,600 page book that then got cut down to 1,000. So there's actually another, several hundred pages of material that we're currently in the process of building into a second volume.
Amazing. Now, can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek as far as what that second volume will contain?
Yeah, well, you know, the contents of the second volume, it's a little bit up in the air right now. The working plan is to make it recipes that are a lot more sort of fun than what was in the first. You know, the first volume is casseroles and steaks and roast chicken and sort of serious things that you might have for dinner or at dinner parties. The second one is more like party foods and snacks. So it'll have there's going to be a big section on pizza, more on hamburgers. There's going to be a big section on like tacos and salads. Sandwiches and things like that. So you know, the idea for a while was foods that you would eat with your hands, because that's how like 90% of the food I consume at home gets eaten anyway. So you know, it's really just sort of fun food and things you might serve at a party or serve, you know, for casual get-togethers.
That sounds, I'm already excited for it. I mean, because who doesn't? I mean, I could geek out on pizzas and sandwiches for years.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there's so much to cover. And what
there
I love
is a lot.
And what I love about pizza and sandwiches both is, like you said, I mean, you can very easily disappear down that rabbit hole of, you know, the bread and the dough and the toppings and the flavor structure. And I'm really excited to see what your take is on both pizza and sandwiches.
You know, the other good thing about pizza and sandwiches, I feel like they're, you know, there's sort of these great equalizers in the food world. I guess burgers are somewhere in there too. But, you know, everybody, whether you're rich or poor or like a broke college kid or, you know, whatever, whoever you are, everybody loves pizza and sandwiches. So it's just one of those foods that I think spans, you know, it's a very democratic food.
So you disappeared down the rabbit hole and you came out with just this massive book that really is amazing. It is quite an accomplishment. I mean, again, just people who, when you pick up this book for the first time, you start reading through it. I mean, I have it in my hands right now. It's the research that went into this is very impressive. And how has, I mean, everything that I've read, the reception on this book has been great and rightfully so, but how has it been on your end? What is it like being a now New York Times best-selling author?
it's a little nuts, you know. I mean, frankly, when I started writing the Food Lab as a column, I did it basically because it was what I wanted to write. And I still do it because it's what I want to write. You know, I always had this interest in science, and then I was a professional cook for many years. And so combining the two together just seemed like something that was really fun for me, and it was something that I'd always wanted to do because I felt like there wasn't enough science. You know, there is food science in the world. Most of it goes into research and or maybe at like very fancy restaurants that can afford to, you know, use ingredients and use manpower to do scientific experiments. But there's not much going on as far as the home cook is concerned. And so that was something that always interested me. It's like, you know, I'm cooking this meal at home. Am I really doing it the best way possible? Are there better ways to get flavor out of these ingredients? You know, is there a way to do it faster or more efficiently? And these are sort of questions that always had always interested me ever since I started cooking. So writing the, you know, when I started the Food Lab on Serious Eats, it was really just, you know, Ed Levine, the founder of Serious Eats, I was having a burger with him, and he was, and I had been freelancing for Serious Eats for a little while, doing like burger reviews and things like that. And he's like, you know, you have this like unique approach to food. What do you want to write about? And I was like, well, I've always wanted to write a food science column. And he's like, okay, you should write a food science column. And I did. And I didn't expect anyone to really read it or pay attention to it. But then sort of from the outset, people, it turned out like there was this audience of people who were really into this kind of stuff and who were interested in the same way that I was interested in it. So I feel really lucky in that sense that, you know, from the beginning, it's been a passion project. And it's something that even if it didn't turn into a book and even if the book didn't sell at all, it's the kind of stuff I'd still be doing in my spare time anyway. So the fact that like I can make a living out of it, I just feel really, really lucky in that regard.
That's amazing. And you know, I mean, the funny thing is too is, so when I ordered the book, you know, I've been following your column for quite a while now, and I expected it to basically just be a really well organized version of all of your columns, which I would have been completely fine with, like a book that I can actually hold in my hand and just go through all your past columns. And it's not that at all. It's mostly new material, right?
Yeah, it's a large amount of new material. It's definitely anything that is existing is sort of presented, I think, in a format that makes more sense in a book, you know, because when you're writing online, it's a series of sort of disparate articles and you can jump from one to the other, but it's hard to really create a sense of cohesiveness and sort of a game plan as to how you're going to teach these lessons or how you're going to maintain the audience's interest. So in a book, you know, I can place them in the order that I want them. I can put interesting, you know, I can put the relevant knife skills next to the recipes that they relate to. I can do sidebars and all these sort of fun things that I think make a book as an object like much more interesting to read than just a series of online articles. But yeah, it is a lot of new material in there. I think when I was done with the 1600 page version, it was about 70% new material, something like that, 70 or 80%. I'm not sure exactly the recipe count. I'm not sure exactly what made it into the first volume, but it's probably somewhere like 50-50 new versus stuff that is in the column online. But you know, yeah, I always felt like, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Beatles, and one of the things that they did as a band that I think a lot of bands don't do anymore these days is that every one of their singles was stuff that didn't appear on their albums. Like every time you bought something from them, it was like a value. It wasn't just like a recollection of old of their greatest hits or anything like that. You know, everything was a value. So to me, that was always awesome. It's like if I'm paying for something, like I want to get good value out of it. So I sort of take that same approach. It's like, you know, if I'm expecting people to pay, you know, my online column is free, but if I'm expecting people to pay real money for like a physical object and I'm getting some of that money, then, you know, it better be a good value. And to me, that means, you know, giving, obviously putting all the work necessary to make it into a cohesive object, but also, you know, giving new material and making sure that when people read it, they feel like they've gotten their money's worth.
Yeah, I mean, and the book itself, I mean, screams value as soon as you pick it up. I mean, even just the cover is beautiful. I love how you chose not to go with a cover jacket. It's just, I don't know what you call that sort of cover design.
Yeah. I'm not sure what you call it, but yeah, that was a pretty early decision to have it without a dust jacket, because to be honest, like, all of the books that I regularly cook out of, if they came with dust jackets, I take them off anyway because they kind of annoy me when you open them up at the kitchen counter. And frankly, like, if I'm cooking from a book, I expect it to get messy. You know, like, I don't expect all my cookbooks to stay perfectly clean. If there's a book that I really value, like, you know, like Harold McGee's On Food and Cooking is probably my number one go-to reference. And that book, I have two copies. I have one that I keep in the kitchen that's sort of my beat up, pages falling out, oil stains and sauce splattered on a copy. And then I also have a clean copy that I keep in my bookshelf. But you know, I do expect the book to get dirty. So I, you know, when from the beginning, like, I wanted this to be a book that is at home on a coffee table, and is at home, you know, somebody reading on their nightstand, but also is at home in the kitchen, is something that you'd really want to work out of. So those design choices, like making sure that the binding is one that you can open it up and it lays flat so that the pages don't, you know, flip closed while you're trying to cook out of it, things like that were all pretty carefully considered. The one thing that maybe I didn't consider thoroughly enough is that that a pure white cover does tend to get messier even faster than other books do. But I just consider sort of, you know, dirty cookbooks to be kind of battle scars. It's like when you get a burn on your arm and it makes you, I think it's a mark of a good cook to have scarred arms.
For sure. And I mean, and as an author, you want to see your book be used and get some dents and dings and stains on it. I mean, it shows that people are actually putting it into action.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Harold McGee, who, I mean, he basically was the foundation for a lot of professional and home cooks alike in their understanding of food science and how to take that into the kitchen. But reading through your book, you know, one thing that really kind of struck me is I'm like, damn, this guy has some really good resources that he goes to for research besides just the ones that I know off the top of my head. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, like when you do the reduction of bacteria to a 7 log on page 30, right? With the, and you're talking about like the radiant energy decay following the inverse square log on page 31,
right?
Like, where do you find this information, and how do you even start your research process to find those sort of you know, nuggets?
Let's see. Well, I mean, so a lot of it, like, I mean, the inverse square law of radiant heat decay is, you know, that's basic thermodynamics, and that's stuff that. You know, my background is in, my degree is in structural engineering,
architecture, but you know, I went to an engineering school, so I took thermodynamics classes, I took physics classes, so all that stuff is sort of basic engineering education, understanding, you know, basic thermodynamics and things like that. You know, for a lot of the other stuff, it really varies from project to project. So, like the bacteria reduction thing, that comes directly from the USDA's testing, and that information is all freely available online. You just have to know where to look for it. But you know, it's a mix. It's some of it is books, physics books and thermodynamics books. A lot of it is just online research. If you Google Scholar has a great search function that lets you find actual academic papers and you know, real hardcore science on a lot of subjects that you might be interested in. It doesn't always necessarily directly apply to the very specific question you have at hand, but you can take lessons from it and apply them. And then, you know, some of it is original testing. You know, I obviously test all my recipes, but you know, I do like to do sort of basic kitchen science experiments too, things that can answer some of the questions that home cooks might have had. And then, you know, I also get emails from readers, food scientists, friends, people that who will come, like, you know, right now I'm actually, so in my book, and right now I'm going to tell you one of the problems with science and with having it written down in book form. So in the book, I talk about how you can cook pasta in a very low volume of water, and it comes out basically the same as if you cook it in a high volume of water. Now, what I'm discovering recently is that's true in most cases, but there are certain types of pasta, particularly like the very high-end artisan pastas that are dried at a lower temperature. So when you're drying pasta, you can either do it at high temperatures or low temperatures. And the high temperature pastas, they take about 4 to 5 hours to dry out. They get a much tougher gluten structure, and the starch gets bound in place much more tightly. So that's most of your supermarket brands. And those pastas are totally fine to cook with a very small volume of water. But pastas that are dried at low temperature, they release a lot more starch as they cook. So those can actually have some problems with sticking to the pan as they cook. So if you use the method that I described in my book to cook very fancy pasta, it probably won't work. And that's something that, you know, like I said, it's a problem because it's in there in the book. But, you know, science changes and we get new information, and you have to be willing to sort of update your previous points of view as new information comes to light. But this whole high temperature versus low temperature pasta thing, you know, I discovered on my own that fancy brands tend to stick more than cheap brands. But it took a reader who is actually a professional food scientist who works for a pasta company to email me and send me just actually even coincidentally he emailed me and he said that, you know, I'm working with this brand and in his email he theorized that that lower temperature drying would lead to more sticking in pasta, and it turns out that completely corroborates you know, the experimentation that I've been doing on my own. So I've been chatting with him about using some of his diagrams. You know, so a lot of the science, a lot of times can come from places you don't expect it. Some, you know, sometimes readers, sometimes old colleagues, things like that.
Fascinating. And I mean, and the low temp, let's talk about that for a second. Why, uh-huh. Why is that? You said more starches, but why specifically have you guys nailed down why a low temp pasta would not work with that technique? Yeah.
yes. Well, it's basically that the when you cook it at a higher temperature, you set the protein structure much more firmly, and so it ends up you know, locking everything in place a little bit more. That's why you know, the supermarket brand pastas tend to be more elastic as well. Like, they can, if you take like a strand of spaghetti from a Berea, say, which is like the world's most popular brand, you take Berea, which is extruded out of a Teflon die, dried at a very high temperature, and you cook that, and you do it next to, like, well, say DiCecco, that's dried at sort of a medium temperature. So you don't even need like the super fancy brands. Just compare Berea and DiCecco next to each other. Cook two strands of spaghetti, pull the ends of them, and you'll find that the Berea is much springier and more elastic than the DiCecco is, and that's another another function of cooking at a high temperature. Which is, you know, it's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. It's just a different end result.
Interesting. I love it. Now, you do a ton of experiments in your kitchen, which I think is one of the reasons why people really follow you and love your work so much, because you're willing to actually do the legwork and test all the different variables. What is, I mean, mm-hmm. I, and with all the testing that you've done, I know it's probably hard to just nail it down to one or two, but what are some examples of either some aha moments that got you really excited or some outcomes that you had in your testing that you just, that completely blew your mind and you had no idea that that would be the outcome?
Let's see, aha moments. You know, the one trick that I've been doing now for several years, and I think actually at the time that I started writing the book, and maybe this didn't even make it into the final book because at the time I was writing the book, I don't think I had quite come to this conclusion yet. But, you know, I worked in restaurants for many years, and then I also worked in test kitchen, magazine test kitchens for many years. And one of the biggest differences between a restaurant and a home cook or a test kitchen environment is the stock that you're cooking with. At a restaurant, you're making chicken stock or veal stock, and it's pretty easy to do because you're in there all day anyway. You have a team of people in there all day. You generate lots of chicken scrap. You have lots of vegetable. You have all the ingredients you need to make it there and the time to make it. So it's pretty easy to make good chicken stock in a restaurant. At home, it's a lot more difficult. Particularly for people who have a full-time job, who come home and they just want a quick 30-minute meal and maybe don't want to spend their entire weekend making chicken stock. So for most home cooked meat recipes, I would call, and many magazines and newspapers call for canned chicken stock or chicken broth. Now, the big difference between restaurant chicken broth and chicken broth that you buy at the supermarket is that the restaurant stuff tends to have a lot more connective tissue that goes into its making, which means that it ends up with a lot more gelatin and it has a much sort of richer, fuller body and a sort of stickier texture and a fuller mouthfeel than the stuff that you buy in the store. And this can have an effect on your soups. Your soups won't taste quite as rich. They won't coat your mouth with flavor in the same way. But it has a much bigger effect on applications where you reduce it. So a pan sauce, for example, or a stew that cooks down for a long time and the broth gets nice. And, you know, if you do it in a restaurant, a pan sauce comes together really easily. It gets really glossy and it has this really nice texture that coats the meat. If you try and do that with store-bought broth, you'll cook it forever. It'll get thinner and thinner. It'll get, you know, the liquid will reduce more and more and more, but it'll never actually thicken up the way that a restaurant-style chicken stock will. And that's sort of one of the essential reasons why a pan sauce at a restaurant is almost always better than making a pan sauce at home. So what I do these days is I just buy packets of gelatin and add them directly to store-bought chicken broth, and it makes such a huge difference in how easily it emulsifies, in the texture of the sauce that you end up with. So that's one of those aha moments. I do it, you know, these days I do it pretty much anytime I call for chicken broth. If it's going to be reduced at all, it's going to get some gelatin in it. So whether it's a stew or a soup or chili or a pan sauce, anything like that, it's going to get some chicken stock.
And what's your ratio for that?
It depends on the specific recipe on the exact application, but it's usually about a quarter ounce per cup. So one packet of powdered gelatin is a quarter ounce. So I would use one of those per cup. It can vary a little bit depending on exactly how long I'm going to reduce it or how thick I want it to get. But gelatin, it's just such a great thickener because it doesn't dull flavors the way that like a flour based roux can thicken up a sauce really well, but it can also make the flavors duller. A gelatin thickened sauce, it gets really glossy. The flavors stay bright. It doesn't add any flavor on its own. It doesn't give you any of that chalkiness or pastiness. It's just a great way to thicken and emulsify.
Yeah, and you just did a post I think a week or two ago on your stew technique. And that that included adding the gelatin, which I thought was a really nice touch.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That one uses a very minimal amount of flour because I think actually for a beef stew, that floury texture is actually something that is essential to it. So it uses a very little, but most people I think use too much, and it gets a little pasty. So it uses a little bit of flour and then gelatin to help it thicken up.
Now, what is a disaster that you've had in the kitchen recently that you couldn't explain at first?
Disaster. I mean, honestly, there aren't that many things I consider kitchen disasters because, I've been cooking for a long time. So most of the time when I go into experimental mode, I'm not just brute forcing things. You know, I'm not like flying blind and just trying every possible thing, I think is how any scientist is going to operate. You don't just go into the lab and start throwing things together. You have a sort of very ordered idea of what you want to do and a list of, and, you know, and sort of in your head you have a probable, your probable solutions, and those are the ones that you want to test. You have to come up with a hypothesis before you can start testing it. So it's actually very rare that I'll start cooking something and end up with something that's really, really terrible, especially these days. You know, obviously when I was first starting out as a cook, I made all kinds of huge mistakes. I remember once I was working in an Italian restaurant, and I was on the pasta station. And I had come in a little bit late one morning because I think I was probably hungover. But I didn't have time to make the – so it was my job to make the gnocchi before service. Mm-hmm. And so the way we would do that, it was a potato-based gnocchi. So you roast your potatoes, you rice them, you add flour, you make a well, you add egg yolks, and you kind of mix it all together with a fork. And then we would pre-cook them, chill them in an ice bath, and then re-cook them to order. And that's how gnocchi was made every day. One day I got in there too late to make the gnocchi before service, so I was in this situation where I had to have gnocchi for service. So I was trying to basically make them to order, and at the same time, I was also experimenting with the idea that, you know, I knew that the more flour you added to the gnocchi, the denser and gummier they become. So you kind of want to limit the amount of flour you add to potato gnocchi. So I was, at the same time, I was very stupidly trying to reduce the amount of flour I was using in the gnocchi even more than I normally was. And so it's not a great idea to do experiments like that for the first time when you're going to be serving them to guests, especially when you don't have the time to correct the problem. So what ended up happening was I made the dough before service, and then I was rolling out the gnocchi and cooking them to order, and they were just completely disintegrating as they went into the pasta machine. And so they completely disintegrated in the pasta machine. And in turn, they kind of fell out of the pasta baskets and then got into the circulator for the pasta machine. So the water stopped circulating. It was a nightmare. I had to call in some favors and get people on other stations to throw pots of water on the stove. I had to get one of the prep cooks to help me make a new batch of gnocchi dough. Luckily, none of the guests found out, but it was a sticky situation.
One of those oh shit moments during service, right when you want to have.
Yeah.
It. Yep. Oh man.
Yep. It's one of those moments when it's oh shit and you know that it's your fault and you know exactly what you did wrong, and one of those things that you're probably never ever going to do again. One of those mistakes you only make once.
For sure. Now you wrote a really nice piece a while back on eggs. And you also have a nice egg section in your book. And one of the things that you talk about is, you know, removing the shell more easily and all the different, dogma and myths behind it. And really it's all about, you know, dropping the egg in some boiling water to set the white at first, then you can lower the temperature later on. Now I've had real good results with cooking my eggs sous vide for any number of applications, but even hard boil, I like the, from a execution point of view, especially when you're passing that recipe off to somebody else, if you have a circulator, I like the consistency that it gives, but I'm constantly having issues, which you explain why in your book, with the shell sticking to the white. Now, besides just, you know, dropping it in boiling water for a couple of minutes, and then maybe dropping the circulator temp down, have you played with that at all, and do you have any suggestions for that?
I mean, what you just said really is, I think, the only solution that I know of is to boil them briefly to start and then put them into the circulator.
Okay.
And that method works for soft-boiled or hard-boiled. The other method, and actually one that I use probably more frequently these days than the boiling method, is just to steam them, because it's fast, it's consistent, and it uses less water, which is important for me out in California here.
Yeah.
You bring out about an inch of water to a boil, a rapid boil in a pot, put a steamer insert in there, and put your eggs directly into the steaming thing and slam the lid shut. About 12 minutes, and they're perfectly hard steamed, I should say. Just like with the boiling method, starting them out in that really hot steamy environment, that very rapidly sets the egg white so that they don't stick to the shell. So they come out consistently, and they're very easy to peel.
Okay. Yeah, and what I like about steaming really anything, but especially the eggs, is you know, the temperature of the steam will stay consistent. So again, when you're passing that off to somebody else versus, you know, if you're dropping, you know, 10 eggs and then, you know, in boiling water, and the next time you drop right. 20 eggs in boiling water, I mean, the water is going to drop at a different rate, come back at a different rate. So.
Right. Well, steam stays relatively consistent. You can still, you know, if you have a very tall pot, the top of the pot full of steam is still going to be cooler than the bottom of the pot right next to where the steam is being generated. Which is why when you see steam when it comes out of the pot, it condenses into vapor, and you can see that vapor coming out of the pot, and so that's a sign that it's actually cooling down when you can see that visible vapor. And usually that happens when it hits the cooler environment of the kitchen air. But yeah, it does stay a lot more consistent, and it flows around the eggs much more consistently than a pot of boiling water will.
Now, you talked about the you're doing the research on the bacterial reduction. And one of the things that I've been trying to find information on lately, but I've been having a difficult time, is I'm trying to graph for various cuts of meat, but specifically chicken, a thermal death curve, because, you know, they tell you to cook it to 165 degrees internal, so salmonella dies pretty much instantaneously.
Less than 2 seconds.
Right, and then with, you know, cooking chicken sous vide, you can do it at 140 degrees Fahrenheit. But you have to hold it there at a longer temperature. Do you have any information or a good resource that we can check out? Because I've had a lot of listeners actually ask me about this too, as far as how to, you know, chart the thermal death curve of bacteria or salmonella, and you know, where to find that holding temperature to make sure that it's pasteurized and safe to eat.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think there's a chart in the book. I definitely wrote an article about it. But yeah, you know, that's based directly on you know, the USDA has done research on that for chicken and turkey and beef and pork, and it's a bit, you know, the USDA website's a little bit convoluted and it's a little hard to find that information. But I think if you do a Google search for like low temperature chicken, my article should probably come up, and there's a chart right in there. I did an even newer article. If you look up Food Lab's Guide to Sous Vide Chicken, there's a chart in there that shows exactly how long you need to hold it at a specific temperature in order to be safe. And the one thing you have to remember is that chickens are not 100% uniform. So a thicker piece of chicken is going to take a little bit longer to come up to temperature than a thinner piece of chicken will. So I always like to build in a buffer zone as well. So if I'm cooking my chicken at 140 degrees, and off the top of my head, I have no idea what that time is, but say it's 35 minutes at 145 degrees, is enough to make to create a 7-log reduction in bacteria, which is what the government considers safe. If I know that it takes 35 minutes at 140 degrees, then I'll bag my chicken, put it in there, and make sure that it give it an extra half hour, an extra 45 minutes or so at that temperature to make sure that it's heated up to the core before I start the countdown on bacterial reduction.
Okay. Now, you come home from work, you've been, you know, busy all day long, or a little bit, you know, you don't have a whole lot of time, but you don't really feel right. like going out. Like, what's your go-to just quick, delicious meal?
does putting some cheese on tortilla chips and microwaving it count?
Hell yeah, that counts.
No, I mean, go-to delicious meal. You know, I tend to eat, I work from home, and I cook a lot for work. So sometimes if I'm super lazy, it's just going to be the recipe I've been testing. But my wife and I get a little bit bored with that, because I'll be testing the same recipe for, you know, a week at a time, and I don't want to eat beef stew every single day for a week. So when I'm not doing recipe testing and I'm trying to cook for us just ourselves, it's usually vegetarian or sometimes seafood based. But I mean, quick and easy, it's gonna be like a stir fry or maybe some vegetables in a taco, something like that. Stir fries, I think, are probably my go-to really quick and easy thing that I think are delicious and easy to throw together with whatever you have, and relatively healthy and tasty.
And you you just moved to San Francisco not too long ago, correct?
Yeah, San Mateo, actually.
Oh, San Mateo, okay. Yeah, I spent some time in the Bay Area when I was cutting my teeth in the restaurant business.
Oh, cool. So, where'd you work?
La Follette, mainly. When I went to, cool. Yeah, so I went to culinary school and then was working at La Follette, and then moved on from there. But yeah, it's a great city. Do you have a favorite, you know, list of hole in the wall restaurants or restaurants that you just love to eat in the Bay Area?
Hole in the wall restaurants. Well, let's see. Down here in San Mateo, Chef Zhao Bistro, that's Z-H-A-O, I think has the best Szechuan food I've found in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And luckily it's just like around the corner from me. But, you know, I spent a long time, when I first moved here, I spent a long time going to sort of every single restaurant that people recommended as having great Szechuan food. So I've been around a lot, and I think this actually is my favorite one. If you're in the mood for a sandwich, Pal's Takeaway, which used to be in the Mission, but is now actually out in Oakland. Pal's Takeaway, the guy, Jeff Mason is the name of the chef there, and he's, I think, a sandwich genius. Makes the best sandwiches.
Okay, awesome.
Those would be my two. As far as holes in the wall go, those would be my two. Neither one gets super crowded, and they're both excellent.
Now, what about on the higher end spectrum? Any favorites there?
On the higher end spectrum, let's see. You know, I honestly don't go out to eat that. When I was living in New York, before I moved out here, I used to do restaurant reviews for Serious Eats, and I would write a restaurant review every week, which meant that I would go out to eat probably 4 or 5 times a week, which, you know, it sounds great, but it can be really tiring, especially when it's just constantly trying new places and finding places that you think are worth reviewing. It's you know, like anything pleasurable, it becomes work when you've done it too much. So when I first moved out here, I no longer had to do restaurant reviews, I kind of saw it as a blessing, and to be honest, my wife and I don't really go out that often these days. Occasionally, we'll make special trips. Meals I've really enjoyed recently. I like going to Kin Khao, which is not super high end, but excellent Thai food. On the fancier, I mean, definitely on the fancier end of the Thai food spectrum. Mm-hmm. Kin Khao is great. I like Francis, which is sort of, you know, one of those California fancy California cuisines. They're Chez Panisse style, you know. Really great figs on a plate type dessert place, you know.
Uh-huh.
Where else do we go? You know, like I said, we don't really go out that often. Heirloom Kitchen. I had a couple great meals at Heirloom Kitchen recently. The chef there is a guy from New England, which is where I'm from. So he's a great chef, and he loves California, and he loves the ingredients you can get out here, which is nice. Those would be my picks, I would say.
Awesome. So I want to be respectful of your time. So one last thing before we let you go.
Sure.
I love the gelatin with the stock trick. What's one more like high impact trick that's easy for someone to implement in their home kitchen where, you know, most people, they're just not aware of it?
Let's see. Well, the one that I utilize in the book over and over and over again is the use of what I call umami bombs. So things that are high in glutamates. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it can be pure MSG powder if you're not afraid of that. But things like soy sauce, anchovies, Marmite, fish sauce, Worcestershire sauce, things that are really packed with these glutamates, which are what trigger our sense of savoriness. So I'll use them pretty indiscriminately in any kind of cuisine. As long as it's like a soup or a stew or something that is supposed to have like a really rich meaty flavor, adding soy sauce or fish sauce or Marmite can really enhance that flavor. So I would say, you know, the next time you're making a bowl of chili or a beef stew or even just a simple soup, you know, try adding a splash of soy sauce or a splash of fish sauce just at the end. And you want to use, you know, just like for a whole pot of stew, I would use maybe a tablespoon of soy sauce and a tablespoon of fish sauce. So not enough that it's going to dominate the flavor, but enough that it's really going to enhance the meatiness of it. And it'll make all of your stews and soups taste sort of meatier without actually having to add any more meat to them.
I love it. Yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of those ingredients. My wife introduced me to fish sauce, you know, over a decade ago. She's from the Philippines.
And, oh, great.
You know, fish sauce, soy sauce. I use it in almost everything, and one of my secrets is when I was doing Neapolitan pizzas at the restaurant, I would do just a small little dash of fish sauce in the San Marzano tomato sauce, and it really did make a big difference.
Yeah, I do. I have I'm on Serious Eats. There's a recipe for a slow cooked tomato sauce. It's like a 7-hour tomato sauce that you do in the oven, and mm-hmm. with that sauce, I add a splash of fish sauce at the end just to enhance the savoriness. And you never know it's there. All you know is like
damn, these are some tasty tomatoes.
Yep. Yeah. Specifically, the affinity that fish sauce and tomatoes have together is just, it's amazing. I mean, fish sauce on tomatoes in the summertime, I've done that in so many different variations, and it really does just bring up the fullness of the flavor in the tomato.
Right. Yeah, you know, because tomatoes on their own are also pretty rich in, as far as vegetables go, they're pretty rich in glutamic acid.
Mm-hmm.
They are one of those sort of very savory tasting vegetables.
Yeah, they almost have a synergistic relationship with the, you know, the tomatoes and the fish sauce.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, Kenji, thanks so much for your time. Big fan. There's a lot of people over on the Stella Culinary Forums that are big fans of your work, and I know they're going to be really excited to listen to this podcast. So thanks so much for joining us. And hopefully we can get you back on when you release volume number 2 of the
Food Yep. Yeah, no, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
All right, thanks, man. Talk soon.
All right, talk to you later.
Well, hot damn. How cool was that? J. Kenji Lopez Alt on Little Old Stellacast, right? Dropping some knowledge. That was a lot of fun. And I do have planned a couple more awesome guests coming up. One that I'm really excited about later on this month is going to be none other than the bread baking guru himself, Peter Reinhardt. And he's going to come on and talk pizza, bread, all sorts of amazing things. So what I want you guys to do, I need you guys to do me a big favor. All right? I don't really ask you guys for much that often. But the Stella Culinary community, I need your help. I want you to go to this episode's show notes, stellaculinary.com/scast19. And in the show notes there, you will find a link to Kenji's book, which you can buy through Amazon. So buy his book if you like his stuff. If you haven't already, buy his book using that link on the website in the show notes. And also, I want you to tweet Kenji and thank him for coming on the podcast and thank him for all the information that he shared. And by doing this, it's showing guys like Kenji and anybody else out there that we want to get on the podcast in the future, showing them that we appreciate their time and we appreciate them giving us the knowledge they gave us on the podcast. I mean, a guy like Kenji, he's constantly busy. I mean, New York Times bestseller. You know, he has his column to write. He has volume number 2 of the Food Lab to write. So, you know, I mean, he took time out of his busy schedule to come on the podcast and give us some great content. So do me a favor, go over to stellaculinary.com/scast19 and check out the different ways to get in contact with Kenji and to buy his book. And just send him a quick thank you. Say, hey, I heard you on Stellacast. Great job. Bought the book. Thanks so much for doing it. And that will go a long way for getting us more amazing guests on this podcast in the future. Now, I do have a copy of Kenji's book to give away. So if you want his book, do me a favor, head on over to this episode's show notes, stellaculinary.com/scast19, and there's going to be a couple different ways for you to enter to win the book. Now, first of all, I must say that this is only open to U.S. citizens. I mean, this thing is like 7 pounds. It would cost me like 3 times the price of the book just to ship it outside the country. All right, so sorry about that, but if you live in the United States, you are eligible, and if not, you can still play along to help support Stellacast, and it'll cost you nothing because to enter, all you need to do is go to this episode's show notes, stellaculinary.com/scast19, and you can do one of a few things. Leave a comment in the show notes and just tell us what you thought about the episode. Share this on Facebook to your friends. Just say, hey, you know, listen to this podcast. It was a lot of fun. We love Kenji. Or you can tweet me and Kenji and just say, hey, thank you, Kenji, for coming on the Stellacast. We really appreciate your time, and it was a great episode. Right, so do one of those 3 things, and make sure in your Facebook post or when you tweet, you tag me. That way I know you did it. And then in about a week, I'll collect all the people who left a comment or shared this on Facebook or sent out a tweet, and I will enter you to win the book. And I'll just draw a name at random. And then once I draw a name, I will contact you and ship the book out your way as a thank you for helping us promote Stellacast and thank a guy like Kenji for spending time out of his busy schedule to come on and do an interview with us. All right, that's it for this episode of Stellacast. Thank you once again for joining me. I hope you guys enjoyed this as much as I did. This episode's show notes can be found at stellaculinary.com/scast19, and that's where you can find links to all the stuff we discuss on this podcast today, and also enter to win a copy of The Food Lab by our guest, J. Kenji Lopez Alt. all episodes of StellaCast can be found at stellaculinary.com/scast, and you can also subscribe through iTunes and Stitcher for free. And that way, when we release new episodes, like the upcoming Peter Reinhardt interview, you will have that automatically downloaded to your device of choice. Also, if you haven't already, head on over to stellaculinary.com and sign up for our free email newsletter so you can get contacted when awesome new content is released, like this podcast episode. And as a bonus, you can download F is for Flavor, my PDF guide. See you guys in the next episode.